Ready? Yeah, good. Okay, so we can continue where we left off yesterday. And one of the points that we were talking about yesterday, which I talked quite a bit about, is the idea of the middle way. Yeah, without not trying to avoid the overly indulgent life and also trying to avoid the tormenting and torturing of oneself. And if you avoid those two sides, then you come to the middle way. And I think this is a very important principle because it is often overlooked and people tend to become too we seem to have a tendency to go to extremes as human beings. Either we just really indulge ourselves or we think indulgence is bad and then we start torturing ourselves instead. There seems to be no middle way very often. And the middle ground is often very difficult to hold because it means it's a kind of it's more subtle, it is more balanced, it is more kind of complex than taking an extreme. It's like politics. In politics, people often go to extremes, yeah, that do kind of extreme things. But holding that middle ground, which is often more complicated because it means seeing both sides of the argument, it means having a kind of, I think, balanced view of things and view of life. And the same thing is true with the middle way. So because of that, I want to look at that in a bit more detail then. And I want to specifically look at how this comes out from the life of the Buddha himself, what happened to the Buddha, and how he actually discovered this idea of the middle way. So we're going to have a little bit of a look at the life of the Buddha today. Yeah, I don't know about you, but I always find it very inspiring to see how the Buddha practiced, to see what he did, and then be inspired by that, and making that also part of our own practice as well. I always find that very, very nice. There's a lot of suttas about the Buddha, what he did before his awakening. And they are obviously there. They are there to inspire us, to remind us that we should be following in the footsteps of the Buddha and do what he did. And of course, to be able to get that, to be able to understand that we should be practicing like the Buddha, first of all, it's important that we have the right idea of what the Buddha is all about. Very often we get the wrong ideas of the Buddha. It's very common to kind of, you place the Buddha on the wrong kind of pedestal. You know, you make the Buddha into some kind of god or some supernatural being or some cosmic consciousness or the Dhammakaya or I don't know what. And this idea of elevating the Buddha, it started very soon after the Buddha passed away. It's an historical development that you see happening over long, long periods of time and getting more and more elevated, more and more miraculous as time goes by. But if we put the Buddha on the wrong pedestal, it means that many of the teachings you find in the suttas where the Buddha talks about his own life and the way he did things, they become kind of irrelevant for us. If the Buddha is not a human being and he is the cosmic principle or whatever, well, his practice must be different because we are not the cosmic principle. Anyone here who is a cosmic principle? No, okay. So because of that, it's like two separate things. So what has the Buddha's practice got to do with us? Nothing. It's only if the Buddha is a human being just like us that his practice actually matters to us. So this is important to remember that the Buddha is human. He's like us. Yes, he took the human potential to the highest possible kind of development. Yeah, this is what is special about the Buddha. But he's not different from us, at least not before he starts out practicing here. So please remember that. Of course, the Buddha is still very impressive what he did, and he still deserves to be on the pedestal, and it's nice to be able to kind of bow down and respect those qualities of the Buddha, but make sure it's the right pedestal, yeah. The pedestal which is kind of the Dhamma pedestal, not the kind of the superstition pedestal. Superstition pedestal is not going to work for us. It's going to destroy so much of what this is about. And this is a problem in Buddhism everywhere around the world, I think, yeah. So let's now have a look at what the Buddha did. And first of all, there's a nice little sutta which I often read out on these kind of retreats. And this is on page 6 in your little booklet there. I'm going to skip the rest of the Dhammacakkappavattana sutta for now, and I will get back to the remainder of the sutta later on. Now I just want to expand, first of all, on the idea of the middle way. And this little sutta is the Buddha. He's talking about his life before his going forth. Yeah, what was it like when he was living the home life? And this is what he says to his monks. Bhikkhus, I was delicately nurtured, most delicately nurtured, extremely delicately nurtured. At my father's residence, lotus ponds were made just for my enjoyment. In one of them, blue lotuses bloomed. In another, red lotuses. In a third, white lotuses. I used no sandalwood unless it came from Kasi. And my headdress, jacket, lower garment, and upper garment were made of cloth from Kasi. By day and by night, a white canopy was held over me, so that cold and heat, dust, grass, and dew would not settle on me. I had three mansions, one for the winter, one for the summer, one for the rainy season. I spent the 4 months of the rains in the rainy season mansion, being entertained by musicians, none of whom were male, and I did not leave the mansion. While in other people's homes, slaves, workers, and servants are given broken rice together with sour gruel for their meals, in my father's residence, they were given choice hill rice, meat, and boiled rice. That's just an extract from that sutta. It continues on after that. After the Buddha talks about, or the Buddha-to-be, he talks about the kind of life he had. This was obviously a very luxurious life for that time. Then he talks about contemplating old age, illness, and death, and then deciding to go forth. Yeah, this is what this is leading up to. But here, all I want to do now is to look at the one extreme, yeah, the kind of life the Buddha had before he decided to go forth. And of course, this is here considered a very luxurious life at that time. In those days, this was kind of, you know, if you had this sort of stuff, wow, you were really living in luxury. Yeah, and it's kind of innocent and cute. Yeah, okay. You know, he's a young man, yeah, and he had three lotus ponds for his enjoyment, yeah, one with blue lotus, one with red lotus, one with white lotuses. Yeah, this is what young men, how they enjoy themselves in those days. It's kind of different, yeah. It's not these days. You know, if somebody gave you a lotus pond, you think, what am I going to do with a lotus pond, for goodness sake? You know, give me an Xbox or something like that. I don't have a, you know, or whatever it is. I don't want to have a lotus pond. So it's kind of cute in a way here, but the point is just to show what luxury was like in those days, and obviously it must have been quite a wealthy family, yeah. If you can build lotus ponds for your son, I mean, gee, it must be quite expensive to build all this. He had three houses, yeah, one for each season. Obviously, they must have been quite wealthy. But what you also recognize with this is that even though they were wealthy, it wasn't kind of extravagant. It wasn't really over the top. There's nothing here about him being a prince. There's nothing here about the Buddha having a palace. It says mansion down there, but even mansion is actually not quite the right translation. The word is pasada in Pali, and pasada in Pali means a stilt house. Yeah, in those days in India, you had lots of floods and things, so you built the houses on stilts. So it was a stilt house. A stilt house can be very magnificent, or it can be very ordinary. It doesn't really say. So presumably it was fairly, it wasn't that magnificent, because we don't really have any archaeological record which shows that things were that magnificent in those days. So he had three stilt houses, and that's what that means. And this is already an important indication to us, because when you start to read the later biography of the Buddha, everything becomes exaggerated. He was the prince, yeah. He lived in this enormous city called Kapilavatthu. Kapilavatthu actually was only a fairly small little place in those days. That's what the archaeological record shows. But according to the legend, it was enormous. He lived in a palace. He had everything. And it's incredibly exaggerated. And this shows you the importance, if you want to really understand what was going on in those days, What you have to do is you have to go back to the earliest sources. That is where you get the most reliable information. And this is a classical example of that. It's very obvious here that this is the real description of what was happening with the Buddha, and later descriptions are exaggerations. So it gives you a very clear-cut sense that the earlier things are more reliable. Because obviously if something is more humble and more ordinary, that is not how people want to remember the Buddha. It's the exaggerated things that are obviously going to be more added later on to kind of make glorify the Buddha. This is a natural kind of human tendency that we would have. So this is the lotus ponds. Yeah, he used no sandalwood unless it came from Kasi. Kasi is Benares, Varanasi. That's what we just talked about in the previous sutta. The same place. Even in India today, you go to India, they say, oh, Kasi, yes, I know what Kasi. Kasi is Varanasi. What is the difference between Kasi and Varanasi? Well, one is like the country with a little bit of land around, and one is the city. And all his clothes, and his sandalwood all came from Kasi. Kasi was the luxury capital of those days, a bit like Paris now, the Paris of India 2,500 years ago. He used upper garment and lower garment, and these garments are called Antaravasakan Uttarasanga, and this is what we have today. This is called Uttarasanga, and the lower garment Antaravasaka. In those days, the dress that the monastics were using and what the lay people were using was basically the same. Yeah, there wasn't so much difference. They had antaravasikas, and the monastics had antaravasikas. The difference in those days was mostly that the lay people would use more colorful clothes. They would have some frills. They would have a bit fancy. Yeah, whereas the monks used kind of standard colors and very simple things. But actually, there wasn't that much difference between the lay people and the monks in those days. For that reason, monastics wouldn't stand out so much. Now we kind of stand out, You look at this and think, whoa, quite unusual. Not many people dress like this in ordinary society. So we kind of stand out more. Some people have said, well, maybe we should start wearing jeans and t-shirts, like everyone else, so that we kind of, just like in India's time, you're more kind of similar to everyone else. Is that a good idea? Monastics wearing jeans and t-shirts? I must admit, I wouldn't like to use jeans and t-shirts myself. It's quite, in a sense, this is like, almost like it's almost like PR, You walk around, people see, oh, this must be a Buddhist monk, and they know straight away you're a Buddhist monk, So that's kind of nice, in a sense, that people recognize that straight away here. Anyway, but there is an argument there that, at the time of the Buddha, the clothes used by the monastics were similar to the lay people. So there is an argument that maybe now, a similar argument can be made. If you look at the Mahayana monastics, they look much more like lay people. Yeah, they often wear kind of trousers, grey trousers, and grey jackets or black or whatever. Whereas the Theravadins, we are, a bit more conservative in that sense. And that's okay. I don't think we should criticize the Mahayana monks or nuns for wearing jackets and trousers, because it was a natural thing that happened in the history of Buddhism. When Buddhism went to China, much colder than India. Yeah, you go to the north of China, it's freezing cold. You have snow minus 15, 10, 15 degrees in the north of China. And of course, you would have to have something more to be able to dress. So you adapt, and that is perfectly acceptable. So these are these clothes used by the lay people in those days, all came from Kasi. And one of the things I would also like to point out, and this is kind of cool for those of you who haven't been to India yet, and this is kind of what I was saying before, is the kind of continuity of Indian society. You go there, sometimes it feels like you're stepping back in time, 2,500 years. Somebody mentioned to me today that when you go to India and you the fire worshippers are still there, they're still worshipping the fire, just like it said in the suttas, 2,500 years later, nothing has changed. Yeah, they're still doing exactly the same thing. You go to Benares, Varanasi, and in those days, that was a capital, of cloth. Yeah, Benares cloth was the best. You go to India, still Benares, is famous for its cloth. Yeah, it's like it is India for you. 2,500 years, the law of impermanence doesn't apply fully to India. It applies fully everywhere else, but not to India in quite the same way. Yeah. But it has a beautiful thing about it. It actually brings the suttas alive. You think, wow, this must be true, yeah, because it's actually exactly what it says. So instead of the suttas being some kind of legend or mythology or story, it actually makes them much, much more come alive. This is actually real. Yeah, this is actually what happened in there. Yeah. So, and then somebody carried a white canopy over him by day and night, so that grass and dew and dust doesn't settle on him. And that's pretty, sounds quite luxurious. Sometimes that happens when you're a Buddhist monk as well. They carry this umbrella over you, and you kind of walk under the umbrella. Sometimes I go to Sri Lanka to give teachings in Sri Lanka, and when I go there, I teach this enormous convention center because our monastery is very famous in Sri Lanka. So when you go there, even though you're not called Ajahn Brahm, I'm close enough, as I said the other day, to get kind of some of the, you know, they think, oh yeah, he's so close to Ajahn Brahm, maybe he must have some of those qualities or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. So you go there and 2,000 people come to listen to your talk. Yeah. And then it's always very kind of formal. You come to the convention center and you have these Sri Lankan drummers, yeah, drumming away. Yeah, and then they bring up this enormous canopy and they hold this canopy over you as if you are some kind of very important person. Yeah, and then they're drumming these drums, and you kind of walk on these red carpets everywhere. You walk through this enormous building, and then they sit you down on this enormous stage with this enormous seat. And then 2,000 people in front of you. Whoa! And that is what happens. And this is similar to this idea of like having a canopy held over you. It's a sign of, you know, of a kind of high status in a sense when these things happen. It's very strange as a monk because you, on the one hand, you kind of live in the forest at Bodhidharma Monastery, yeah, just by yourself, you know, and when you are with your fellow monks, they don't really take you very seriously, yeah, your fellow monks, they say, yeah, or whatever, yeah, they're kind of, and then you go to these places like Sri Lanka and there's 2,000 people and everything is so formal, it's, the contrast is so enormous. And actually, you never really take yourself too seriously because you go back to the forest afterwards and everybody treats you like you're just anyone else. So you can't really take yourself too seriously here. But you learn to be very flexible and you kind of deal with all these things, which is quite nice in a sense, and quite useful, I think. Yeah. You don't, Ajahn Brahm never allows you to these things to go to your head. Yeah, he will always kind of bring you back down to earth again very quickly. This is what a good teacher is supposed to do here. Anyway. So he had these three stilt houses, yeah, one for each season. And then in the rainy season, because the monsoon in India is very severe, you can't really go anywhere, you just chill out in that house full of musicians, full of female musicians. And then the very last part here is also quite nice, and this is just this idea that in his house, all the workers and the slaves and the servants, instead of being given just the ordinary food, they were given special foods also as well. Not just the family, but all the workers at the same time. So it was also a house of compassion, a house of kindness. Yeah, if you want to have a really good household, it's not just about the wealth. It's also about the kind of the qualities, the personal qualities that come out that are important. And sometimes we talk about people being born into very good circumstances, you know, being born with a silver spoon in the mouth, or whatever it's called. Yeah, but actually the real silver spoon is whether you have been reborn in a good family, whether your parents are good, that's the real silver spoon. That is the real privilege. Because if you haven't got that, then all the wealth and all the material things in the world are not going to do very much for you. So this is the Buddha's past. This is his kind of upbringing, so wealthy for the time, yeah, obviously quite wealthy when you see this, I would say, he was also born in a very high caste, so very top of society in many different ways, And this is then shows us the one side of the equation, the indulgence in sensual pleasures. You can see here, obviously, this was quite indulgent. Yeah, it wasn't just being comfortable, it was way beyond being comfortable, where you actually really enjoyed yourself in this way. And that, I think, is the important distinction. This important distinction in meditation practice, especially when you go on retreat in ordinary life, you don't have to worry so much about it. Just make sure you keep your five precepts at least. But when you go on retreat, this is what you should be aiming for. You should be aiming for being comfortable, being at ease, feeling good about yourself. Yeah, it is not when you're comfortable, you're not indulging. When you're comfortable, you're just at ease. Indulgence is when you go beyond that and you kind of gulp down sensual pleasures. Yeah, you just enjoy them. Give me more sensual pleasures. Yeah, you're craving for them. But being at ease just means that you have no craving one way or the other. You're just comfortable and at ease in the present moment. There's an important distinction there between comfort and at ease, and indulgence on the other hand. It's the indulgence that we try to avoid on retreats. And anyway, when you go on a retreat, you come to Jhana Grove, for example, it's very hard to really indulge very much. It's not set up for indulgence. Yeah, you can't really indulge. Isn't that right, Shri? You come to us all the time. You are always coming down there. You say, can you indulge at Jhana Grove? Shri, is that right? Yeah, is that close enough? It's hard to really indulge, yeah, because you get your little room, they can only do so much. Okay, you can have a cup of tea in the afternoon, that's not really a big deal. That's kind of okay. Yeah. So that is where, how this is the right way of thinking about this. So this is one side of the equation. Now I want to look at the other side of the equation, which is the self-mortification. But to do that, I want to look a little bit more fully at the Buddha's, how he went forth, how he was thinking and all of this. Because actually, it is quite interesting to look at all of this. we'll be repeating some of the things we're talking about yesterday, but actually I still think it is quite nice and quite worthwhile. And this here is a combination of two different suttas, Majjhima 26 and Majjhima 36. And I have just mixed them together randomly so that you have absolutely no idea which sutta it is from. So I hope you will forgive me for that. But it's just to kind of make it flow a little bit. So that's why I have done that. Both of these are long suttas about the Buddha's life, especially before his awakening, but also a little bit after his awakening. So here we start. This is from Majjhima 26, the Noble Search Sutta. Bhikkhus, there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here someone, being themselves subject to birth, seek what is also subject to birth. Being subject to old age, they seek what is also subject to old age. Being themselves subject to sickness, they seek what is also subject to sickness. Being themselves subject to death, they seek what is also subject to death. Being themselves subject to sorrow, they seek what is also subject to sorrow. Being themselves subject to defilement, they seek what is also subject to defilement. So here, the point is that, you know, already I have all these problems. Then I go out into the world and I get these other things that also have exactly the same problems. Just to multiply the problems to make the situation worse. Already there is a problem here. That's why it's called the ignoble search. It's ignoble, not because it is you are not an aristocrat or anything like that, but it's because it just leads to suffering, yeah? That's why it's ignoble. The noble search is always the search that leads towards more happiness and more a removal of problems and suffering in the world. So what may be said to be subject to birth, subject to old age, to sickness, to death, to sorrow and defilements? Let's just look at the death one. We don't have to go through each one of these because they're very similar. What may be said to be subject to death? Wife and children, or if you like, husband and children, are subject to death. men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to death. And you could probably also add, if you like, the possessions, yeah? In some of the other ones, talks about gold and silver, in other words, money and that sort of thing as well. All of these belongings are subject to death. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to death, seeks what is also subject to death. This is how the Buddha thinks, or the Buddha to be, he's not the Buddha yet, but the Buddha to be, how he thinks about this. So first of all, he realizes that he has a problem. I will die one day, yeah? And because I will die one day, then what most people do in this world, well, they seek all of these things, yeah? This is what you're seeing here, wife and children, is obviously, this is just your closest family, yeah, the people around you. All this other stuff, the elephants and all of that stuff, that's just belongings in general. In those days, having animals was a very kind of... these were kind of belongings of the highest kind, yeah? Your wealth was counted in the number of cattle you had. So if you had lots of cattle, wow, you're very wealthy. That's one of the ways of counting the wealth in those days. How much gold and silver you had, of course, was also important. But of course, all of these things, all our belongings, whatever it is we have, especially people, they're also subject to death. So here you are, you already have a major problem in your own life. You're going to die, yeah? And then you go out seeking all of these other things that are also going to die. And of course, if you seek them, and as it says here, once you seek them, because you are seeking, because you are craving, it means that when you get these things, you attach to them. You get infatuated by it. Yeah, you adhere to it. You hold on to it. And as you hold on to all of these things that are subject to death, well, you are asking for trouble. You're asking for suffering in the future. And this is what the Buddha to be is seeing right here. I have a problem already, and now I'm going to multiply that problem enormously by attaching to all of these kind of things. And that is why it is called the Ignoble Search. And of course, once you see that, you realize that, well, the vast majority of people in the world, they are committed to the Ignoble Search. Yeah, there are not so many ones who are committed to the Noble Search, because this is how most people live. And... not just lay people, some monastics live like this as well. Yeah, they have all kind of stuff which is really not really appropriate for monastics. So it's just part of a human condition that we tend to kind of go in this direction. So this is then the Ignoble Search, because it doesn't lead anywhere. It doesn't lead you out of suffering. It leads to more of the same. And then you get reborn, and because you're already doing this, you continue doing the same thing in your next life. And on it goes, forevermore. After a while you think, jeepers, why am I doing this? And the Buddha had come to this particular point when he started realizing, why am I doing this for? And he started to look for a way out instead. So that is the Ignoble Search. And then at the bottom of page 7 there, it says, what is the Noble Search? Here, someone being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the freedom from what is born, the supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to old age, having understood the danger in what is subject to old age. He seeks the freedom from old age, the supreme security from bondage, from attachment, Nibbana. Being himself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, he seeks the freedom from sickness, the supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Being himself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, he seeks the freedom from death, the supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Being himself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, he seeks the freedom from sorrow, the supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Being himself subject to defilements, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, he seeks the freedom from defilement, the supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. This is the noble searcher. So this is why people sometimes find the suttas boring, yeah? Because it says the same thing. What? How many times? 6 times. Like one word is changed in the middle there. Like, goes death, old age, etc. But the point often just is that it can drive home the message a little bit when you read it like this. So if you have the mindfulness and you feel peaceful and at ease, you may actually even come to enjoy this kind of repetition a little bit. The Buddha to be is turning in a different direction. Yeah, having understood the danger in these things, understood the danger in attaching to things that are going to die. You turn your mind in a different direction. You seek the freedom from these things instead. Here the translation is unborn or unaging and deathless are the translations here. And I don't think that they are necessarily the best translations. I think the freedom from these things is what really this is getting to. The Buddha is seeking an end to these problems. Yes, he's seeking a freedom from these things. And the Pali, ajata, amarana, ajara, etc., it actually means, normally it means quite exactly that, a freedom from these things. So I think that is a preferable translation here. So you seek a freedom from this, yeah, from the supreme security here, from bondage. As long as we are bound to the world, bound to samsara, these things will happen again and again and again. Now you are looking in a different direction for these things. This is very similar to what I was talking about the other day here. When I was talking about, remember, the idea of impermanence, the idea that all conditioned phenomena are impermanent, unreliable. There's nowhere to stand. It's almost as if the ground is always shaking in a sense. The carpet is being pulled out from under your feet. If you're standing on the carpet and somebody comes and pulls it out, what happens? You fall over, you can't stand there anymore. And this is like impermanence. It's like that. There's nowhere to hold on to. There's nowhere you can stand. There's nothing to rely on anymore. You can't rely on even the ground. The ground is like shaking, like as if there's an earthquake. As soon as you hold on to something, you're asking for trouble, for suffering. You're going to fall over and hurt yourself. This is what impermanence is like. Once you get this idea, it kind of becomes very powerful. And this is what the Buddha is basically saying here. He's saying, don't attach, don't hold on, don't... the word that he uses, don't commit to things, don't be infatuated, don't be tied to them, This is like attachments, because once you attach, then you are attaching, holding on, you're relying on the ground, which will start to shake with an earthquake before you know it. And then you will fall over, and you will hurt yourself as a consequence. This is what the Buddha is saying here. And the first step then to seeking Nibbana, the Buddha here is saying, let me seek Nibbana. Of course the Buddha doesn't know, or the Buddha to be, he doesn't actually know what Nibbana is at this point. So here what he's seeking for is that just that liberation, the freedom from these things. And the first step in doing that is always to remember we move gradually. So the first thing to do is to move towards those things that are a little bit more permanent. And that is the mind. The mental world that you take with you from one life to the next one. And building up the mind, which also is the path of liberation anyway, because a pure mind and a positive mind is that path to freedom from all of these things. This is the first thing that the Buddha then does, and we will see this later on, is to purify himself fully so as to be ready for awakening experience itself. Exactly in the same way, we have to follow the same thing here, same ideas. You learn to, instead of focusing too much on the results in this life, the results of what we're doing, and whether we are kind of achieving A or B here, we focus on the process. It is a very interesting, different way of looking at life, instead of always focusing on the results. This is what we try. That was what life is like. We're always focusing on getting somewhere. I want to get to this particular point. I want to have success in my work. I want to have such and such a house, such and such a relationship. We have this idea where we want to go, and the result is what matters to us. But a person who is wise doesn't focus on the result. Because if you focus on the result, all it gives rise to is craving. Yeah, you're driven towards this result all the time. Craving keeps it going to get there. Yeah? This is why we work so incredibly hard sometimes to get to that particular point. Instead, the wise person focus on the process. How do I get to the result? Much more important than the result itself. And this is why it doesn't matter if you are a layperson or a monastic. Because both for a layperson and a monastic, the process is what matters. So if you work hard, working hard is fine, but don't worry so much about the result of what you're doing. Worry instead about the process. How are you doing it? Are you doing it with kindness? Are you doing it with generosity? Are you doing it with compassion? And if you are imbuing the process with the right qualities, you will feel much more at ease. You will be making good karma in the meantime. You will be purifying yourself. You will be brightening up your mind. And at the end of the day, you will feel good about yourself. And then if the result comes, wonderful, that's a bonus if the result comes, yeah. If the result doesn't come, actually it doesn't matter so much because you've been living the process in the right way anyway. You're still developing yourself, yeah. And because you've been doing everything else right, actually the result isn't that important to you anymore. But if you live a life where the result is everything, if the result doesn't come, you feel terrible. Yeah, you have worked so hard, for goodness sake. You've been showing your boss, you know, how you've been working all these extra hours, putting all the extra effort, and now your boss doesn't really care about you. He doesn't really kind of give you that promotion or whatever it is. It's so unfair, yeah. I deserve it, but they're not giving it to me. There's nothing you can do about it because your boss is in charge. And this is what it feels like. But if you have been putting in the right qualities, you understand that how we do things is much more important than the results. Then you still feel content, you still feel happy. You think, yeah, whatever, life is uncertain, you never know whether the results are going to happen. And then you carry on in the right way. And this way, you're building up all these positive qualities inside of you. This is the distinction between a wise person in the world and a person who doesn't have the bigger picture, who doesn't understand what really matters in life. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that success is bad. I think success is great. Yeah, success is wonderful. I'm not saying that we shouldn't pursue careers to some extent. I'm just saying how we do it is actually what really matters in life. And if you do it in the right way, then you are doing things according to the Dhamma, according to how the Buddha said we should be doing things. So this is like, in a sense, what the Buddha is talking about here, yeah? But he's talking about it in the kind of sutta way, which can be sometimes a little bit, it's a very high kind of way that he's looking at it from these things. He's talking to the monks, so you might kind of expect that. And then the Buddha goes on. Because before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought what was also subject to all of these things. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilements, do I seek what is also subject to all these things? Why, being myself subject to all these things? Yeah. Suppose that being myself subject to all of these things, having understood the danger in them, I seek instead the freedom from birth, the freedom from old age, the freedom from death, the freedom from sorrow, and the freedom from defilement, the supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Yeah. This is then the Buddha's thought, the Buddha to be's thought. Before my enlightenment, while I was still an unenlightened bodhisattva, the Buddha didn't know what was going on. He was unenlightened. He hadn't seen the truth yet. And one of the beautiful things about this paragraph here is that you hear the Buddha says, I myself was subject to birth and death, and I sought all of these things that also were subject to death and birth and old age. Yeah? He was just like us. Yeah, he's not different. The Buddha had the same kind of delusion like people have today, all of us have today. There's no difference there. You see here, you see the humanity in the Buddha to be. He was a human being. And notice these little things because they give you a very accurate picture of what the Buddha actually was. And I will point these out as we go through these suttas, that the Buddha, before his awakening, he had the same exactly the same problems as we have today. There is no real inherent difference between the Buddha and us. The difference is that the Buddha was able to find his way out of this, and that is actually worthy of incredible respect, to be able to find that way out. But in the end, he also is a human being, just like we are, with the same problems that we had. So he was unawakened. It says here he was a bodhisattva. Yeah. So what is the bodhisattva doing in here? Is this kind of Mahayana Buddhism infiltrating the Theravada? You think that's what it is? the answer is no. It is not accurate. That's not what is going on. This is very likely to be part of this from the very ancient sources. And in fact, it makes sense, because the Mahayana teachings, they also would have to come from somewhere. The idea of the bodhisattva would have to arise from something. And what all of these things arise from, they often arise from the early Buddhism. And everything is taken from there and then expanded and changed from the early Buddhist suttas. So the bodhisattva in the early suttas is a very different idea from bodhisattva in Mahayana, or even the developed Theravada tradition we find in the commentaries. Theravada also has bodhisattvas, yeah? The idea that you should be practicing for eons and eons to kind of become a Buddha is also found in the Theravada tradition, but it's found in the commentaries. Here it has a very different meaning. The meaning here is the person who is seeking awakening. And it refers to the Buddha after he left his home life, until he became enlightened. Yeah, so it's only a very short period of time. He leaves the home life, and then he searches for awakening for a few years, and then he finds awakening, and then he becomes the Buddha. He goes from being bodhisattva to becoming the Buddha. And that is really the meaning in the earliest suttas. It has nothing to do with this practicing for eons and making a vow under a previous Buddha, all of that. All of that is legend stuff. It's mythology. You know, nobody really knows what happened to this person called, now called the Buddha, long time ago. This is legendary stuff that has arisen long time after the Buddha passed away. So this is the meaning of bodhisattva. Usually the word bodhisattva is not bodhisattva, but bodhisattva. And the sattva in Sanskrit means a being, and bodhi means awakening. So the idea of bodhisattva means awakening being. It's kind of a little bit strange, yeah? And there is another way of looking at this word, and that is seeing it as equivalent to the Sanskrit bodhisakta. Bodhisakta, sakta means to be like intent on, or to kind of be, you know, something that you are attached to, holding on to. And this is the idea of the Buddha being intent on awakening, being attached to awakening in a sense. And this fits much better in this context, yeah? He has left the household life, now he is intent on awakening. If it's sattva, awakening being, it's kind of slightly strange, but bodhisattva, intent on awakening, makes very, very good sense in this particular context. So I think that it may very well be the meaning of this word right here. And if you look at the new translations by Ajahn Sudhakar on Sutta Central, that is exactly what you find. That is how he has translated it. Just excuse me for 1 second. Okay, so this is the Buddha before his awakening, and again, you see there how he is in many ways, just like us, but then when he realizes the problems with the world, and this is kind of one of the powers of a Buddha to be, he has greater insight into the problems, he sees the problem much more clearly, and then he takes drastic actions to try to avoid that and eliminate the problems. Yeah, there's a wisdom faculty there which is very powerful, and this is what kind of distinguishes the Buddha to be from most people. So he decides to seek the deathless, yeah, or to seek the liberation from all of these problems. And now I'm I should have put a few dots in there or made some mark, because now I'm moving on to Majjhima 36. And that's why the text suddenly changes so abruptly. You may wonder what was going on there. That's because now it's another sutta. I'm suddenly starting another sutta. And you can see here how it continues in very much the same way as the previous one. Here, Agivesana is the person he's talking to. Before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, same thing again, I thought, household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from home life into homelessness. So this is another consideration. The Buddha-to-be obviously had many considerations, and he was quite obviously very kind of observant person. He saw things from many different angles. So this is another angle from which he approached the idea of going forth. And the thought here, so he has already decided there's a problem, and then he thinks, well, should I be a lay person or should I be a monastic? What is the right approach to solve this problem? And then he talks about lay life. He says it is crowded and dusty. Is that right? Is it crowded and dusty? I think maybe in those days even worse, even more crowded and dusty than it is now. Now it's not quite as crowded as it was in those days. Because you read about that everybody kind of maybe living in one room, and the kind of things were a bit more difficult, depending on how wealthy you were. But it is kind of crowded, when you live in a family life, you have people around you at all times. It's different from living in a kuti by yourself in the forest, a different feeling to it. And I know that. I mean, I go back to visit my family maybe once a year, all the way back in Norway. It's strange, once you kind of come back to your family, your family treat you just like they always did, you become the kind of the son again, and they treat you a little bit like they always did, not entirely, because they realize that something has changed, but a little bit like that, you can see how many of the old habits, how easily they can resurface once you're back with your family. There's something about being close with other people that has a tendency to give rise to defilements and ill will and passion, because we are so close to each other, we rub up against each other, there isn't much space for withdrawing, getting away, and because of that, it is very hard to live family life without ever getting upset with anyone. It's very rare to do that, because we are so close together, and that's what does it. And this is part of what the Buddha means here by the problem of dusty, the dust in the suttas is a word for defilements, really. So the defilements are stirred so easily when we live very close to other people. Whereas the life gone forth here is wide open. You have more space around you. You have more room. And you can withdraw when you feel that your defilements are kind of getting the better of you. When I get a bit upset with my fellow monks, I just go back to my kuti. I try not to shout at my fellow monks. So I go back to my kuti instead. And I kind of withdraw a little bit. But that's much more difficult to do when you live in the household life. So this is part of the problem. This attachment to people around us all the time actually makes it more difficult to live the path of Buddhism fully. And this is what the Buddha-to-be is realizing here. By withdrawing, it is easier to live this path in the right way. It is not easy while living in the home life to live the holy life, the brahmacharya, utterly perfect, paripunna, utterly complete, is what it really means, and pure as a polished shell. Complete means certain factors of the path, you may not be able to fulfill them. And because you may not be able to fulfill them, it is virtually impossible to go all the way to the end of the path in the same way as a householder as it is as a monastic. Much more difficult. So this is what the Buddha to be is reflecting here. So this is quite important. I think this is why the Buddha laid down the monastic life. He didn't just lay down the monastic life so you could kind of, chill, you don't have to work so hard. It's not quite like that. There is a reason for this, and the reason is precisely this. It actually enhances your ability to practice the path. And this is why, generally speaking, in the world, if you want to find people who are awakened and enlightened, it's more likely to happen among monastics. Yeah, because they are actually, hopefully at least, and not all of them, but some of them at least, are more committed fully to the path, to practicing it in, you know, absolutely. That's why you find people like Ajahn Shah, yeah, and other kind of great monastics, Ajahn Brahm, or many, many others, who kind of, you look at them and you realize they have qualities that are not easy to find, you know, in the world. Not many people have these kind of qualities. And that's why we respect that. And of course, the Buddha is the one who started all of this. So then he decides, yeah, to shave off his hair and beard, put on the ochre, not really, not yellow, ochre robes, like brownish robes, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. So that is the what the Buddha thinks. And then later, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. Yeah, while I was still a young and black-haired young man, don't wait too late. Don't wait till you're full of gray hairs, yeah, and you kind of, we're going for it. Do it when you're young. That's when you have the ability to practice this path fully, when you're young. When you're old, well, you know, you're pretty stuck in your habits, and it's much more difficult to adjust to monastic life when you are kind of 60 or whatever. But in your 20s or 30s, that's when you really have the ability to practice this fully. So don't wait. If your child says, I want to become a monk, or I'm say, yay, go for it, yeah, check it out. Try it out. And if they try it out, they may not like it, okay, they come back again. But if they enjoy it, then, you know, they can carry on. You know, when somebody becomes a monastic, it's a wonderful thing. You know, they have an opportunity to become a blessing for themselves and for so many people around them. If they live an ordinary life, it's okay, it's fine, it's not going to, you know, it's okay. But you don't really become a blessing for the world and for yourself in the same way if you live an ordinary life. Also, it enriches your own relationship with, you know, a child or with a family member if they actually go forth, because you can actually start talking about things that are a bit more meaningful. Yeah, and because I'm talking about all the ordinary stuff we talk about. When I go back and visit my parents these days, we do a bit of meditation together. We talk about Dhamma. You know, that kind of stuff. That's what we do. And I think, great, if I had been a layperson talking about all this other rubbish that people talk about. So I'm really, really glad about that. That we're talking about something decent, something useful, instead of talking about rubbish things. This is the power of the Dhamma. And it's interesting, you know, you had some of the BGF members here who become monks at our monastery in Perth. Yeah, Lei Han and Lai Peng, who are down there. And we have more, we have another young man from Penang who is about to become ordained. CC, you know CC? Yeah, you know CC? Yeah. A very nice young man. He's very, very extroverted young man. He's very, very nice young man there. And that's wonderful when that happens. So we have people, and I want to say people from all over the world, yeah? They become the Dhamma Dutas of the future, and they can train them, and when they're ready, we send them back, yeah, to KL, to Penang, to Norway, to, I'm not ready yet, I've been a monk for 23 years, I'm not ready to go back to Norway. So I'm being a bit slow there. No, but I don't know if I ever will go back to Norway, actually, but whatever. So it's this kind of, yeah, and then you take it back again, and then you help the local people in the place, and you have a new relationship to those people. Yeah, imagine if Lei Han, he's now Venerable Radha, yeah, novice monk in our monastery, when he comes back to here in a few years' time to teach, it would be a different kind of thing, yeah, it would be a different feeling about it. And it would be very powerful for you when you get one of your local people to teach Dhamma to you. It would be very interesting for you, because he will probably teach in, I don't know, what will they teach in? What is the most common language? Is it Cantonese? Hokkien? English. You teach in English, okay. We can also teach in Chinese, yeah? That would be nice, wouldn't it? But you all speak different dialects, is that right? So you can't really understand. Okay, so we could probably teach in English. What about Malay? Teach in Malay, would that be nicer? When was that? Muslims, yeah. When I was in Indonesia, you cannot teach in Malaya. Yeah. Ah. What if they speak English to Muslims? Ah, but then, okay, then it's no problem, yeah. Yeah, yeah. 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 Sure, yeah. Even when I was in Indonesia, yeah. Okay, I'm just joking around a bit, yeah? Don't take it too seriously. Take it too seriously. So, whatever language, yeah? Sometimes the silent language is the best one. You just sit there. And people say, wow, this is really good. And everybody feels really peaceful and nice, yeah? Sometimes you don't have to say very much. There's a very famous, one of my favorite monks, Ajahn Gunha in Thailand. Yeah, we had a kind of whole group coming from Perth, and I went to visit him. Ajahn Brahm was the leader, and all these other lay people were coming with him, and they really wanted to hear some teaching from him. So they asked, oh, you know, Ajahn, please, you know, give us a teaching. We want to hear about meditation practice, yeah? And Ajahn Gunha says, breathe in, sabai. Breathe out, sabai. That's it. That was the whole teaching. Yeah, sabai in Thai means at ease, relax, yeah, enjoy. That's what it means in Thai language. So that was the whole teaching. And actually, it's a very good teaching. If you understand what he is on about, it means that when you really relax and you watch the breath in an easy and relaxed way, that is where you get the results. You just have to learn how to relax properly. You have to work on that. And then when your breath meditation that's where your breath meditation really starts to take off and really has some really powerful benefits. So it's good. So sometimes being quiet, actually, there's a powerful teaching in that. I probably talk far too much. Yeah. 4 hours every day plus Q&A. I should probably, maybe next lesson, what is that? Maybe we can just sit for 1 hour quietly and see what happens. No, probably not, but we'll see how things go here. So that is important point. Go forth when you are young. That is where the Dhamma is really powerful. That is when you really have a chance to make a difference. And then next one is very interesting. Though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces. Yeah, so obviously the Buddha-to-be, he had spoken to his parents. He had obviously said to them, I want to go forth. Yeah. And then they said, please don't go forth. You can imagine if you have a son like the Buddha-to-be, he would have been a pretty impressive son. Yeah. Pretty kind of amazing son. And the last thing you want him to go forth, you want him to take on the family business. Yeah. Just like these days, you want your children to take over your family business. It's exactly the same thing at that time. So he spoke to his parents. And of course, the implications in this is that the Buddha wasn't irresponsible, like it is sometimes made out. You know, the traditional story in Buddhism is that the Buddha, in the middle of the night, he kind of says goodbye while his wife and child are sleeping, and he gets on the horse, Kantaka, and he rides off, and he jumps over the wall of the city, Kapalabhati, and kind of disappears. You know, yeah? That is kind of the traditional legend that we always hear. And why do we hear this? Well, we hear it because it sounds very good. But it was made up a long time after the suttas. This is not what really happened. What really happened is this. The Buddha spoke to his parents. His parents said, please don't go. We love you so much. Just like parents do these days. Yeah? Nothing has really changed. My parents also were not very happy, I can assure you, when I decided to become a monk. They said, no, what are you doing? It's crazy, this is not what we didn't bring you up to kind of to become a monk. What is a monk anyway? We don't even know what a monk is. That's part of the problem. You have no idea what is going on there. So he obviously, the implication here is that he made sure that his son and wife were being looked after here. He didn't just leave them like that. The Buddha was not irresponsible. He was responsible. He made sure everything was okay. And then he went forth. So it's a very common kind of technique. You see this, you know, in many Buddhist countries you have all these Christian missionaries, you know, very well known in places like Sri Lanka, for example. And they say, the Buddha, irresponsible, yeah, don't follow the Buddha, he's no good. Come to us and say, Christ, he loves you, yeah, so Christ much better. That is kind of techniques. It's not even true. It's not even what happened. And even if it had been true, it still wouldn't make any difference as far as I'm concerned. But it actually isn't even true. And this shows you, going back to the earliest sources, going back to the suttas, seeing what is there, it often gives us a very different picture of what is going on than the later legends and mythology that we have. So, he does all this, and shaves off his, and then he goes forth from the home life into homelessness.